Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 15th of January, Dr. Martin Luther King's actual birthday. This hour of the program, we're going to be talking about the safety of our food supply. We're probably far enough away from lunch that I won't spoil your appetite if I remind you of what's happened in a little less than a year and a half. Part of our conversation prompted by U.S. News and World Report with an extensive story on this issue in this week's issue. An E. coli bacteria outbreak is in bagged fresh spinach in California, killing three people and sickening more than 200 others in 26 states and Canada. Salmonella in patches of Peter Pan and Great Value peanut butter, sickening hundreds of people. Salmonella-tainted tomatoes in restaurants. E. coli-contaminated lettuce from California served at Taco John's restaurant. An E. coli outbreak in iceberg lettuce. Salmonella contamination warning issued for banquet chicken and turkey pot pies. A nationwide recall of a children's snack, Veggie Booty. Reports of illnesses by Tops Meat to issue a nationwide recall of millions of pounds of ground beef products. And the list goes on. So what's going on with this? The number of outbreaks and cases of foodborne illness almost doubled in the U.S. between 95 and 2000. The types of outbreaks are now more varied, and we'll be looking at why that is the case, how this is what kind of oversight we have here, what agencies are responsible for checking the safety of the food supply, if indeed we can do that, because our food is coming from all over the world now. We'll look at this issue this hour of the program, and our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. We have two guests with us. Professor Mickey Parrish is professor and chair of nutrition and food sciences, College of Agriculture and Natural Resources at the University of Maryland. Professor Parrish, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Thanks for asking me.
Yeah, our pleasure to have you here. Also joining us is Michael Doyle. Professor Doyle is a Regents Professor of Food Microbiology and Director of the Center for Food Safety at the University of Georgia. Professor Doyle, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Let me get both of your takes on whether or not we're seeing more and more cases of food contamination, or if it's just that the press is on these stories more. Are we seeing more cases of this, Professor Parrish?
Yes, I think we are seeing an increase in cases. Part of that is due to better surveillance by the agencies, but there is a concern that some of these outbreaks that we're seeing may be due to the fact that we simply have fewer inspectors out there. We have fewer people who are actually on the ground doing the inspections and trying to find these problems.
Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that, Professor Doyle?
Well, I think we are seeing more cases, and I think a large part is attributed to better surveillance. The state health departments and CDC surveillance programs get better and better every year. And the other observation is that we're seeing more meat-related E. coli outbreaks, and there's something unusual happening there. The meat industry can't explain it, but for sure we're seeing more outbreaks than we have in the past few years.
Mm-hmm. Have we seen significant changes in the way that we're growing our food? We keep hearing about these complexes where you got the cattle close to the vegetables, close to water supplies, potential contamination being there just because everything should perhaps be separated more than it is.
I'll jump in real quickly.
Sure.
I think that we are seeing some changes in consolidation of many of the larger food companies. If you stop and think about ground beef, when I was a kid growing up in Central Florida, we would walk down to the local butcher, and they would grind the meat right there. Now there are actually some centralized facilities around the country where they ground beef in huge, huge quantities. So I think part of it is simply just a consolidation such that if there is a contaminating event, it's going to affect a lot more people than in the previous days when you could get ground beef at your local market.
Mm-hmm. Professor Doyle?
Well, to that point, there's been a finding that consolidating these types of meat processing operations can have a, can be very positive in the sense that there's better hygiene than what would happen in the back of a, a grocery store. But there are other issues. It's not just the consolidation of the industry that could lead to food safety concerns. We're seeing major changes in our import of foods. And in many countries, the way that food is produced is not up to our levels of sanitation.
Mm-hmm. Let's spend a few moments here on the inspection system. My understanding is that we just are woefully short of inspectors for all of this. We just don't have people on a daily basis, the many that are needed, to inspect all this food. Why is that?
Well, there's not enough money to go around to do that. But the USDA and the FDA are operating under different statutes or laws. And the FDA is a system that they don't the law does not require inspectors to be on the premises while the product is being processed. That's in contrast to the USDA. When meat and poultry is being processed, an inspector has to be there. And so there's like 7,600 USDA inspectors for about 6,000 meat processing plants. And in contrast, FDA has about one inspector for every 100 food processing facilities. And so food processing facilities under FDA purview, which is about 80% of our foods, is inspected on average about once every 2 years.
Once every 2 years?
On average. There are some plants like infant formula plants that would be considered a potentially higher risk. They would be inspected more often. And then other plants that would be of a lower risk would be less often.
Professor Parrish, I'm sure that the American public, if you took a poll, would say overwhelmingly get more inspectors here once every 2 years is simply not enough.
Well, absolutely. And I think part of the issue here is that we've seen a large cutback in the amount of support being provided to FDA specifically to regulate foods. And that has translated into fewer people working at FDA. That's part of the problem. And certainly it would, if the consuming public should be concerned and should be expressing their concerns to their local congressional representatives to try to do something about this. It's my understanding that recently that the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition, which is the food arm of FDA, has been told that it will be receiving increased resources. But even at that, as Professor Doyle said, USDA has 10 times the number of inspectors, although FDA actually regulates 80% of the food supply.
And why is there such disparity here, Professor Parrish? Why is that?
I think that this really goes back, as Dr. Doyle said, goes back to the fact that they are governed under two different statutes. The USDA is governed by the Meat Inspection Act of 1906, as well as the Poultry Products Inspection Act and the Egg Inspection Act that were passed in later decades. FDA is governed by the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938, plus some amendments that have occurred over the years. And they actually require, they give them different authorities and different powers.
Would you say that it is time to update, to change, and are there any attempts to do that? The jurisdiction of the FDA and the amount of money, the number of inspectors put in that organization, Professor Doyle?
Definitely. It's time that changes occur. Some of these laws are over 100 years old, and and for their time, they were relevant and appropriate, but times have changed, and we definitely need to update and upgrade. And yes, Congress, certain members of Congress are addressing this. It's not going to happen overnight, but I think in a matter of a year or two, there'll probably be some major changes initiated.
Mm-hmm. We, of course, pay a lot of attention to these stories when we get this massive outbreak of E. coli in spinach. I listed some of the big outbreaks that we've had at the top of this show. Have we determined what caused those outbreaks, or do we get to a point where we say, well, maybe it was this, maybe it was this, chances are pretty good it was this, but we don't have a definitive answer?
Well, in many of these outbreaks, we're never able to definitively say what the source is, but our epidemiologists and the FDA, as well as state health departments, are getting much better in terms of investigating outbreaks and coming up with possible sources. For example, the spinach-related outbreak, they were able to isolate the same strain of E. coli that caused the outbreak from pigs, wild pigs that were in the area of where the spinach was grown, as well as from cattle in the vicinity and so on. So they were able to trace it back to a degree and come up with possible scenarios, but not definitively.
Mm-hmm.
I would agree with that. I think part of the problem is it is very difficult to state exactly what happened in any particular outbreak, and really seldom do you come up with absolute 100% proof. We can certainly come up with proof within a reasonable doubt, and I think that's the end product for most of the investigations that are occurring today. But I would agree that FDA and state departments are doing a much better job now than they were perhaps 15 or 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what we do know, for example, with the spinach-related outbreak is that cattle are a common carrier of this E. coli, and so cattle are likely to be the original source of the E. coli involved in the outbreak, but how the E. coli got from the cattle manure to the spinach is another question, and maybe it was these feral pigs that, you know, rooted in the cow manure and then passed it on through the soil or into the spinach patches.
Well, when these kinds of things happen, both of you are experts in this field, do you get calls from the government? Are you asked to go to the site to try to trace what happened here?
Well, I have on occasion.
Uh-huh.
We work closely with the CDC in some of the outbreak investigations. But FDA, depending on what type of food it is, if it's a meat poultry product, then USDA gets involved. And if it's other types of products, then FDA gets involved. And they've got some very competent people who are involved with these investigations.
Mm-hmm. Are we seeing an increase, Professor Parrish, in the number of raw fruits and vegetables that have been contaminated?
I think what we're seeing is a combination, perhaps, of additional contamination, but also the fact that the government rightfully is asking people to consume more raw fruits and vegetables.
Right.
The five-a-day push by USDA, I think, is important for nutritional reasons, and we don't want to inhibit people from consuming raw fruits and vegetables. So part of it is simply there's a greater consumption. There perhaps is or isn't additional contamination occurring, but the combinations of people eating more, some of the newer products such as bagged salads that have been on the shelves mm-hmm. for several years, the way they're produced in mass, perhaps contributes to the perception that there's additional increases in outbreaks.
Mm-hmm. What about this transporting of foods? When you brought up bagged salad, I'm thinking about where that bagged salad originates, and then you got refrigeration issues to deal with. Should we be looking more at getting food that's within a 100-mile radius of our homes?
Well, there certainly is a push for people to think about eating locally, and there's nothing wrong with that, but let's also understand that eating locally doesn't necessarily mean that a product is safer or more nutritious or even quote-unquote greener in terms of greenhouse gases and other impacts on the environment.
Mm-hmm.
It's also sometimes difficult to get foods year-round from one location. And California and Arizona, for example, are the primary locations where certain types of lettuce are grown throughout the year.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we want to eat lettuce year-round, then we're going to have to transport.
Let's welcome phone calls for both our guests. We're talking about how safe our food is. Over the last year and a half, the list of food items that have been recalled due to contamination has increased and includes a wider variety of products. We're looking at oversight here at these agencies, the USDA and the FDA, and there being just not enough inspectors to look at all of the facilities here, why that is the case, what can consumers do to make sure that their food supply is as safe as possible. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Milwaukee area callers, 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Like to send us an email, you can do that at talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, we'll be talking with the author of a terrific book. It's titled Caught in the Middle, America's Heartland in the Age of Globalism. The author, Richard Longworth, spent a lot of time in the car, 11,000 miles on the road in the Midwest, looking at globalization and how it has really transformed the Midwest. So that's coming up tomorrow. Please listen. It's a really good book. Okay, let's go to phone calls for our guests, and they are Professor Michael Doyle, Regents Professor of Food Microbiology, Director of the Center for Food Safety at the University of Georgia, Professor Mickey Parrish, Professor and Chair of Nutrition and Food Sciences, College of Agriculture and Natural Resources, University of Maryland, and we start our calls with Elizabeth from Fish Creek. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. Thank you for addressing the subject. I heard about a book, Spoiled. I heard about it on public radio quite a few years ago and got it and found it very disturbing. A couple of things I just want to ask you about that I learned in that book are that they describe that European standards are significantly different than the standards we use here specifically for meat processing. I know that one of the things that rolls to the front of my mind is the difference between having a whole lot of chicken floating in a large vat where any that are contaminated can contaminate, you know, the remainder in a really large container. And apparently the reason for that is allowing them to soak up more water so they can be heavier and you can charge a higher price for them. I understand that in Europe that is not legitimate and that they have just a batch of different practices that they use that minimize the transfer of harmful bacteria from one unit to another. The second issue they describe is that they claim that we severely underdiagnose certain ailments in this country that we widely attribute to other things, such as stomach flu. We all hear about stomach flu, and stomach flu doesn't really exist. And I know that not too long after I read the book, I had a girlfriend come down with a stomach flu, and I immediately said, oh, no, we underdiagnose in this country. That sounds like Campylobacter, and we pulled my book out and looked at it. And she went back to her doctor and said, my girlfriend's head is going to pop off if I don't get tested for this. And he said, no, you don't have that. That's really rare. I've only seen it 3 times. She insisted, and, of course, the reason I'm telling this story is she had it. And I know that the feature he kept looking for was, well, you had your dinner with other people and none of them were sick. So it can't be that. And my understanding from Spoiled is that is a false measure that doctors can use. And the reason this matters is, first of all, we really need to know if this stuff is out there in a much more pervasive way than we understand. But also, some of those diagnoses really matter down the line because there's a correlation between, for example, Campylobacter and an onset of autoimmune diseases within 6 months. So that's a risk factor we need to know about. So I'm wondering if you can comment on any of these things.
I'm sure they will. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Professor Parrish first.
Well, I would say let's consider that regulations certainly are different in the United States and Europe. The European Union has a single food safety agency set up in the recent years. I would hesitate to say that European regulations are better or more thorough than our own regulations. We certainly, in many instances, are envied by many other countries for the way we do regulate our foods, even though we have seen additional problems, perhaps, in the recent years. So I would be hesitant to say that in all cases. Now, there are differences, and certainly we can learn from European regulations some things that perhaps could benefit us as well, and at the same time, they learn from us. So let's just be cognizant that there's good and bad on both sides.
Mm-hmm. Professor Doyle, you want to comment on her?
Well, to the point about the salmonella in chicken in the EU versus here in the U.S., there's a lot of variation among countries in the EU in terms of their salmonella contamination levels. For example, in Hungary, they have a very high level of salmonella contamination, and in some other parts of Europe, a relatively low level of contamination. And our level of contamination is somewhere around 10% or less, which is much lower than what they see in Hungary, but a little bit higher than some other parts of Europe. Also, in eggs, for example, in Spain, they have real problems with Salmonella enteritidis in eggs, whereas here in the U.S. we have a much lower incidence of Salmonella in eggs. So I don't think it's fair to say that the Europeans have better rules or laws or ways of processing food than we do here in the U.S.
Well, I didn't get this 10%. What's 10%?
Oh, 10% of our raw poultry.
Uh-huh.
Is contaminated with salmonella.
10%?
About 10%.
Wow. But you can cook a lot of that away.
Well, the proper handling and cooking will eliminate the problem.
Wow. Thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Ann from Madison next. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I think your guest from the University of Georgia said there wasn't enough money for inspection. And I think that that's not really true. It's just that the money is in the hands of the very, very rich who aren't contributing in any real way to our tax base. And that means because they don't want inspection in the case of, huge factory farm owners, they're essentially bribing our public officials to get rid of the regulation that would mean our food supply was safe. And I think that what we really have to do is go back to essentially, it doesn't have to be immediately local agriculture, but people can hold, before globalization, corporatization of our food supply, people mostly bought, either grew their own stuff or bought from fairly nearby sources. We don't need pineapple in the middle of winter in Wisconsin. We'll survive without it. But you can hold local farmers responsible, and local farmers, small family farmers, even a little bigger family farmers, didn't want this kind of globalization system without any regulation. They fought against it tooth and nail. They just don't have any money under our present corrupt system to do anything about going back to a safer, more accountable food system. I don't think you can take politics out of the inspection problem.
All right. Anne, thanks for the call. Professor Doyle, you want to start?
Well, sure. I really don't think it's a matter of corruption in our food system. To be honest with you, this is the first time I've ever seen consumer advocates and the industry, the food processing industry, getting together to try to recruit more monies for the FDA through Congress. The FDA has lost money, resources for the last 5 or 8 years, and inspections have gone down dramatically because of that, as has other things happening within the food side of FDA. So there's a real concern among the food industry to address this and to try to get it fixed. The other point that was made was about food imports, and I would agree that our system for inspecting food imports is seriously out of date. And considering that the trend is we're going to see more and more food imported, something needs to be done. Changes need to be made to upgrade our food safety inspection system to bring it to the same level that it is for domestic inspections.
What do we need to be doing?
What do we need to be doing?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the FDA has proposed we need to do more in terms of prevention, which means that food importers will need, if it's a big company in the U.S. that buys ingredients from China, for example, they need to have more oversight of how the ingredients are produced and sent to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And also, the way we verify that foods from other countries are safe is the FDA will visually inspect and test a certain sampling of those products coming in. And some of the methods and sampling procedures that are used today are quite old, out of date, and could be updated so that we can do a more efficient job
mm-hmm.
in testing.
You want to give us your comments on this too, Professor Parrish, please?
Just very briefly, I would suggest that our inspection system, the inspectors on the ground are doing really the very best job that they can. There are just so few of them. And I really don't agree that there is corruption that's causing bad food or contaminated food to get through the system. People are really honestly trying to do their very best. The Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition, the building is about 1 mile from campus, so I interact with those folks quite a lot, and I admire their dedication under extreme duress to continue trying to do the very best job that they can.
Let's go next to Ross from Appleton. Hello, Ross.
Good morning, you guys. Great program, as always. And my question, gentlemen, has to do with food irradiation. I'm just curious as to why we don't see more irradiation used. I'm familiar with hospitals, and I know a lot of the products used there are sterilized using irradiation. I think it's the same technology. I could be wrong. Just curious as to why we don't see more of that, and I'll hang up and take your answer off the air.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I'll jump in. I would agree with you that it is essentially the same technology that you use for medical supplies to ensure sterility of medical supplies can be applied also to foods. The public has been given the impression over the last many years that irradiation has been potentially used for foods. They've been given the impression that somehow food will become radioactive and will therefore be bad for them if it's consumed, when in fact that absolutely is not correct. There may be any type of processing of a food is going to result in some changes to the food. Irradiation has very minimal changes to most food products, and it will eliminate the large majority of any contaminating pathogens. So it actually could be a real boon to those people who like perhaps a raw hamburger, not raw, but rare or medium-rare hamburger. If the hamburger's irradiated, your risk of becoming ill from that is greatly reduced.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Dan from Plymouth. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I'd like to comment about inspection. You know, I feel sorry for these inspectors. Back when Reagan got to be president, he cut a lot of rules and regulations from meat inspecting and stuff like this to keep costs down and produce more. And that was only one department he did it in. And as far as chicken in ice, in water, it is not to gain weight. It is to keep a viable product, because if the skin dries out, it turns brown and has a unappealing look. But yet there are chicken producers that do pump water into their chicken.
Mm-hmm.
That's about all I got to say.
Okay. Thank you so much, Dan, for your call. Professor Parrish?
Well, I agree with Dan that part of the problem that we've had over the last many years is with inspections, just simply the fact that the agencies responsible for conducting those inspections, mostly FDA, have been cut back to the point where it's extremely difficult for them to do their jobs.
Mm-hmm. Professor Doyle?
Yes, All I can say is I agree. Yeah,
I agree.
More money needs to go into both agencies.
Right. Yeah,
I agree.
And as we talk here, sometimes it seems as though it's just by whim that these contaminations occur. Consumers want to know, and you don't know when you're going to get caught off guard here, precautions that they can take. Is there something that we can do that's foolproof?
Well, from a microbiology standpoint, much of the food that we consume, we have control over, in the sense that if it's a raw meat, for example, you can, if you properly handle it, wash your hands, avoid cross-contamination, and properly cook it, it's safe.
Mm-hmm.
The hard part is the chemical contamination. Mm-hmm. That is, if there's antibiotic residues or certain types of pesticides, which sometimes come in with imported vegetables or other types of raw materials, some of these are heat stable, so you can't cook it away.
Mm-hmm.
And so then it has to be regulated away. It has to be prevented from happening.
Right. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. If you'd like to send us an email, it's talk@WPR.org. And our guests are Professor Michael Doyle, Regents Professor of Food Microbiology and Director of the Center for Food Safety at the University of Georgia, Professor Mickey Parrish, Professor and Chair of Nutrition and Food Sciences, College of Agriculture and Natural Resources at the University of Maryland. And our next caller is Jill from Manitowish Waters. Hi, Jill.
Yeah, hi. A book by author Nina Plank called Real Food. She gives evidence of that meat, like beef raised in feedlot situations, has this dangerous E. coli strain in its gut, and meat raised on grass, you know, grass-fed beef, does not. And so her conclusion and others is that it's the feedlot system of raising the beef that is the problem, where also the veterinarians on site say most of these animals would be dead within a couple of days if it wasn't for all the antibiotics they're giving them. I've called in with this comment before and get, like, no response. Why isn't there any science looking into this? And I presume it's because of the huge amount of money involved in the traditional agribusiness method of raising meat, and that is the problem.
All right, Jill. Thanks very much for the call. Professor Parrish?
Well, Jill, actually, the USDA supports research through a competitive grant process. And if there are topics that you feel are important, you can contact them and indicate that you believe that this is a topic that deserves scrutiny. I do believe, actually, that there is research that's being conducted in the area of looking at how beef cattle are raised, specifically with the idea of how do diets, et cetera, affect the intestinal microflora, and how does that impact the E. coli 0157, which is the pathogenic strain of E. coli that typically is a problem. So if there's if you have some desire to try to have an impact, I would suggest you contact the Cooperative States Research and Education Service through in USDA and indicate that this is a topic you believe deserves funding.
Mm-hmm.
But I can tell you that some of that research has already been done, and it's been documented that grass-fed cattle carry E. coli 0157 just as much as grain-fed cattle. In fact, in Scotland, where they have one of the highest incidents of E. coli in cattle, those cattle are largely grass-fed. So I don't think the data support what was suggested.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for your call. Oh, we need to pause for a moment. We'll return. We're talking about the safety of our food supply, and our guests are Professor Michael Doyle, Regents Professor of Food Microbiology, Director of the Center for Food Safety at the University of Georgia. Also joining us is Professor Mickey Parrish, Professor and Chair of Nutrition and Food Sciences, College of Agriculture and Natural Resources at the University of Maryland. Here's the number once again, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you could do that as well, and that address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, we'll be talking with the author of Caught in the Middle, America's Heartland in the Age of Globalism. He is now our guest tomorrow at this time, a fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, was an award-winning foreign correspondent and senior writer at the Chicago Tribune, and he spent, and is a heck of a writer, spent a long time and drove his car 11,000 miles all over the Midwest, and the book is what he calls a report from the front line of America's new economy. All right, back to phone calls now on the safety of our food supply. Let us go next to Pat from Richland. Hello, Pat.
Well, good morning. Good show.
Thank you.
The two ladies that called previous to me were both right on the mark. If it was more local produced food and somebody got sick off it, they'd be out, that producer would be out of business. We wouldn't need somebody from Washington to tell us what's safe. Also, it's worth keeping in mind here that food is a necessity. We need that. It's not a luxury. What is it, like 80% of the tomatoes in the stores are grown by two farms? Kind of like that with beef, too. There's only a few beef slaughterhouses. I want these guys to tell us how much the food supply in America is monopolized. And do you think American people would be comfortable with that?
You want to start, Professor Parrish?
I would hesitate to say that the food is monopolized. I would say that there has been consolidation so that there are fewer companies today who control larger segments, but you find competition in virtually every segment of the food industry. So I would hesitate to say that it's monopolized. But yes, there has been consolidation. There are larger companies involved, and that's the reality of the global marketplace.
Professor Doyle?
No, I would agree. I think Dr. Parrish has answered the question.
Mm-hmm. And thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Bill from River Falls next. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how you doing this morning?
Fine, Bill. How are you?
Good.
Good.
I had a question on a while back we had a big flurry activity about melamine contamination in wheat gluten that was used in dog food. But I haven't heard any mention of that wheat gluten entering into the human food chain. I wondered if your guests would comment on whether that's a probability that contaminated wheat gluten might have entered into the human food chain as well as the animal food chain. That's it.
All right. Thanks for your call. Professor Doyle?
To my knowledge, FDA had done a pretty thorough investigation and determined that the wheat gluten had been used in feed animals, and did a follow-up determination to evaluate if there could be any carry-through to the human food supply through the animals that may have been fed, and the net result was that the dilution effect was so great that there was not likely to be any toxic effects from from that scenario. So, to best of our knowledge, humans were not likely to have been exposed to toxic levels of melamine.
Mm-hmm.
And I would agree with Dr. Doyle. I'm familiar with much of this investigation, and it was really one producer of melamine in China that was a major cause of this, and to our knowledge, that ended up in feeds and pet food and not in human food.
Mm-hmm. And what, you know, we hear about these stories, but then it goes away. What happened with that story?
Well, it didn't go away within the federal government. I can tell you that within FDA and within the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition, and with also the Center for Veterinary Medicine, it remained a large topic of discussion and investigation, and to my knowledge, they are continuing to look into just exactly what did happen.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go next to Kathy from Milwaukee. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I have a question. I often go to farmers markets, and I get my fruits and vegetables, and I also buy poultry. And a farmer I bought this year, actually this past fall, a duck, and I asked him, he said it was organic, and I asked him, what does he feed his ducks and his chickens? And he said, just corn. And so I'm thinking, if he's not giving them antibiotics, and if he's only feeding them corn, are they really getting enough nutrients just from the corn to fight off any diseases? Wouldn't that lower their immune system, just being fed one thing?
Well, Kathy, I'm a food microbiologist, as is Dr. Doyle, and I'm not really a physiologist that and know anything about avian physiology and how nutrients are used. So I would hesitate to say that it would be bad for ducks to be fed only corn. That's a topic I think you would need an expert to comment on.
Okay.
But having grown duck in my younger days, if this was an organic situation where the ducks are grown outdoors and not in a confined area, they would likely be exposed to a lot of other things like grass and organic material that would be more than just corn. So I suspect that there are other types of nutrients available to them that ducks in the wild would also be exposed to.
Hmm.
That's a good point.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to Justin from Antioch, Illinois. Hi, Justin.
Hello. My question was, I was wondering if there was any talk of stricter penalties for companies who distribute contaminated food rather than taxpayers paying more for U.S. inspectors, having the companies inspect themselves more.
Well, there are penalties for in different degrees of penalties depending on if it was intentional or if it was knowingly added versus if it was unintentional and so on. And in the end, there usually are major lawsuits associated with these types of outcomes and also a loss of reputation and several other negative effects that occur. So from what I see, food processors do what they can to avoid any type of contamination where possible.
And thank you for the call. We go to Ron from Marshfield next. Hello, Ron.
Yes, good morning, everyone. I don't know if I'm missing the obvious here or not, but I see this news footage of these fields of produce that go on as far as the eyes can see, practically. And there are all of these laborers out there slaving away, and they're probably out there for 10 or 12 hours a day. And I don't see a porta-potty or a wash basin anywhere in any of that footage. And I'm wondering, am I missing something here or what?
Ron, I would say yes, you probably are perhaps missing that, because there are regulations in most states requiring that sanitary facilities be provided to field workers. And I know in the state of California that this is looked at very closely. And not only that, but the farms require that the field workers use those porta potties and use those hand washing facilities. So I think that this is not as big of an issue in the U.S., and I would not be concerned so much in the U.S. about field workers contaminating the produce.
Okay, great. I feel better already.
Thank you. Thanks very much for the call. Joe is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Joe. Hi, Joe. Are you there? Joe's not there. Our number is 800-486-8655-227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. We had a caller who couldn't stay with us who has an interesting point here. The USDA and the FDA, do you think that they need to be redesigned? Do we need to start from scratch here again, or can we Can we add to the inspectors? Can we add to the oversight of both of those agencies to make them truly effective? Professor Parrish?
That's a really good question. And that's something that has been discussed in Washington here for quite a while. Do we need a single food safety agency in the U.S., or is our present system adequate? I would say that certainly, if given the appropriate resources and the mandate to cooperate among the agencies, that probably we would be okay with the current system that we have. If that does not occur, then I think it's perfectly appropriate for Congress and the public to consider establishing a single food safety agency.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to Joe from Milwaukee. We'll try again. Joe, are you there?
Yep, I am.
All right, go ahead.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking the call. I agree with a previous caller who said, and I feel even more strongly, that because of the corrupt administration that we have right now, this administration has taken away money from all kinds of social environmental programs, and I, too, feel sorry for all the good people that work at the FDA, the USDA, and I know that a lot of them are extremely angry. I take exception to the comments from the experts that you have on there when they say that irradiated food isn't bad, for instance. People need to go to sites like Organic Consumers Association and, for instance, Dr. Mercola's site. The Organic Consumers Association says that research has revealed a wide range of problems in animals that eat irradiated food, including premature death, a rare form of cancer, reproductive dysfunction, chromosomal abnormalities, liver damage, low weight gain, and there's more. And also, irradiation destroys vitamins, enzymes, and disrupts the chemical composition of food. And it masks and encourages filthy conditions in slaughterhouses and food processing plants. Now, I've been a member of Organic Consumers for many years, and I would put my money on them rather than on what the FDA and USDA says. In addition, when the lobbyists for Monsanto and Agricon and other of those corporations, they send their lobbyists to Washington, the senators and representatives turned their back on the American public, and they hold out their hand, and those guys get away with murder. They have polluted the earth with so many genetically modified organisms. Right now, our corn supply, soybean supply, canola supply is more than 50%, in some cases up to 80-90% contaminated with organic genetically modified organisms. And this is allowed to exist in this country. We're one of two nations in the world that still allows our BGH in our milk supply. And all the other countries have banned it. So nobody is going to tell me that the FDA and USDA are protecting us in this country. And those are my comments.
All right. Thanks, Joe, so much for the call. Professor Doyle, you want to start?
Well, in terms of irradiation, FDA scientists, toxicologists, and others have reviewed the data that are available in terms of the safety consequences of irradiating food, and have concluded that irradiating food is a safe process. And it's not just the FDA. Internationally, the World Health Organization has made the same claims. The food, the FAO internationally has made the same claims. So, in general, the scientific community accepts the fact that irradiating foods is a safe practice.
Mm-hmm. Professor Parrish.
I would agree with the comments from Dr. Doyle. There really is honestly no credible scientific evidence that irradiation of foods is going to cause considerable illness or cause problems of any significance in the general public. So I would have no problem in consuming irradiated foods.
Okay. One more call. We have about a minute left. Diana from, that's the wrong line. There we go. Diana from Waukesha. Hi.
Hi. I I have an issue that I'd like to ask about in cookbooks. When they tell you about making eggnog, they don't tell you any way to sterilize the raw egg, and, of course, it's not cooked. And I'm just wondering if there's some kind of spices or lemon that one can use.
All right, I'm not sure our guest has an answer, but Professor Parrish, do you?
That is a real problem. No, I would. I do not know that there is any particular way to sanitize an egg. Now, there are producers who are producing pasteurized eggs in shell, and there's also pasteurized eggs that you can purchase that are in cartons that can serve that purpose as well. So, if I were making eggnog, I would want to probably go to a pasteurized egg product.
Thanks very much for your call. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us this hour. It's an important discussion. Thanks.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Our guests, Mickey Parrish, professor and chair, Nutrition and Food Sciences, College of Agriculture and Natural Resources at the University of Maryland. Michael Doyle is Regents Professor of Food Microbiology and Director of the Center for Food Safety at the University of Georgia. We thank them both for being with us. And direct your attention to U.S. News and World Report. Their issue this week is on U.S. food safety. Homegrown problems abound. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and to Rhonda as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks for all of your interesting calls. Tomorrow, a reminder during this hour, I think an important discussion, maybe we'll do a series of shows on this, Caught in the Middle, America's Heartland in the Age of Globalism. Richard Longworth has written an important book on this, and that will be our subject tomorrow at 10. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.